You're listening to In Focus on 107.7 The Wolf. I'm John Damschroeder, and my guest today is Dr. Edward J. Kane, a longtime professor of finance that I knew when he was at Ohio State back in the 1980s. Today, Professor Kane is at Boston College, and Professor Kane is the author of a very provocative book built upon his many years of research. That book is called Banking on Bull Bleep. It's basically using data and logic to show us that the banking system and the political and legal system that supports it is a giant con game, victimizing average people like us. Walk us through the concept that bull bleep is backstopping our banks, Dr. Kane.
Well, avoiding the proper second syllable takes away a lot of the force of it all. Actually, that there is a philosophic literature now that is philosophers, one at Princeton in particular, wrote a book entitled On with the Proper Word, bull bleep.
This is actually on the radio.
Okay, well, the radio should be able to handle that, especially since so much of it is coming out of Washington, D.C. these days. I don't imagine there's many listeners who could come up with as forceful and apt a synonym for what we're observing. And the book actually makes a point of distinguishing between horse bleep and bull bleep. The idea being that the horse bleeper doesn't care whether you believe him or her or not. They just going on, but that bull bleep is really meant to persuade you of something, in this case, that the government's got this all under control and it's all for our good and not for the good of the biggest banks in the world.
So your key finding is that the big banks have been protected from financial risk through forced subsidies from taxpayers, and that citizens are not benefiting from that political decision. Now, number one, would the financial system have collapsed without that forced bailout?
And the word collapse is puts in mind of buildings falling and earthquakes and so on. So I wouldn't use the word collapse. There would be a lot of losses that would have had to be distributed. It would have been a painful process. And the bailing them out massively without penalizing any of the stakeholders who supported this, other than, of course, the stockholders took a burn, but the creditors were all paid, and the creditors were paid risk premiums that were really falsely paid on the grounds that if they weren't going to fail, then you didn't need to pay them the big risk premiums. But there was always a chance that the government wouldn't be able to bring it under control. So maybe that would have been that would have supported small risk premiums, but not big ones.
So if we were going to do this, we bail out the banks, was there a way to do it in that citizens who were kind of forced into this would have benefited more than they did from the way it was handled?
Let me back up. You said citizens didn't get any benefits from this. Well, that's not really my thesis. My thesis is they didn't get sufficient benefits. That is, having the world's banks all fail is a man-made disaster whose damage we would want to limit. So, in the interest of all of us. But what was really outrageous is the argument that Timothy Geithner made, that any punishment meted on the debt holders, the people who bought bank bonds and things, would really just destroy the rescue. And that's just not true. It seems to me that anyone who invests in bonds knows that there's risk entailed. And while they may not want to see the risk turn out sourly, still they understand they're big boys and women and know that this is the way the game is supposed to be played. You know, you buy stuff, and if you buy it in the right companies and they do a good job, you'll get paid too. And if they have just told you a lot of, sold you a lot of sunshine and nothing comes out of it, then you take a loss. And that discipline is what makes capital in general go to the right places, the places that can make the best use of it.
Well, now, a lot of what you call banking on BS could also be called corruption of capitalism. Essentially, policies and laws that protect financial predators over society as a whole. I mean, yeah. Right now, we're in a situation where the largest owner of residential property in the United States of America is a hedge fund that picked up foreclosed homes of citizens that were given loans on real estate that they couldn't handle. But the point being here, the way this was handled actually benefited the financial elite and helped them enhance their holdings, didn't it?
Well, let me go back to your company. That the we can talk about what are other ways of having saved the banks. And one way would have been to say we're going to give subsidies to the homeowners that are underwater. Now, this actually would have been led to much happier results for the society as a whole. But the trouble is that was too transparent. If you gave the subsidies to the homeowners that had taken on mortgages they couldn't handle, this would be seen automatically as a transfer from sort of careful homeowners and renters to these speculative homeowners. And yet people never saw that, okay, so if we give it to the banks, we're just leaving the banks to go and punish these people for their wildness in buying a home they couldn't afford. But it didn't do us any good. We still paid the same bill. You know, and if we'd put more of a face on what was happening, perhaps somebody could have sold this, but sold the idea of helping the mortgage borrowers and keeping so much churning in house prices and so on. But it would have been much harder than just simply saying the world was coming to an end and we had to rescue the banks or we'd all be in poverty.
Now, just to make it as clear as possible to our listeners, you've long held endowed shares that were funded by bankers. So when Dr. Ed Kane comes to the conclusion that American bank executives are protected against punishment for criminal behavior and that the U.S. justice system has a duty to reform the law to protect citizens, average citizens, from criminal bankers, that is a big conclusion. That could not have been easy for you to make.
Adjustment here. You know, big banks are the ones who are in this situation. Small banks are victims just as we are. That a huge number of small banks disappeared in this crisis. So that it's the really big, the big banks have increased their market share substantially. Their stock prices have gone up by substantial multiples. And many small banks were forced out of business.
Yeah, you know, when I first met you, Ohio was in the midst of the first banking crisis since the Great Depression. State-regulated home state savings was insolvent, and ultimately laws that restricted banks to the state of their charter were liberalized to allow out-of-state bankers to come in and take over home state and solve Ohio's crisis. And then in the national savings and loan crisis that followed shortly thereafter, the same formula was followed, and suddenly the United States was a land of large national banks. But yeah, the banking rogues of that S&L crisis in Ohio and nationally went to prison.
Yeah, well, that's the main difference, isn't it, between the great financial crisis and our Ohio crisis and the S&L mess. I don't like to call the SNL mess a crisis. It was just a mess, but it was too small to really have to be dealt with right away, and it was allowed to fester for a long time. And finally, the first president, Bush, decided when he was elected, that was a good time to try to clean that up. So, but the effect of all these franchises disappearing and the deposits and loans going with them to very big banks is absolutely on target.
So what happened between the savings and loan crisis where activity
you
want
to call
was,
it crisis,
well,
to call it
the mess, banking executives who were involved in that, whatever we call it, were judged to have committed criminal acts.
That's right. Various kinds of fraud and misallocation of resources. And again, this was just not done this time because the banks were bigger. I mean, you know, political power determines often whether somebody gets indicted or not. You know, even arraigned, I guess. I don't know the exact terms of where you decide that you're going to first accuse the person and then indict them and then try them. And there were not many indictments, and there were only a few trials.
But we can establish that the conduct itself that caused the issue was not materially different.
No, but the fraud laws also protect people that have enough money to hire good lawyers, because two parts of the fraud test are about intention. Can you prove an intention, not just that you fooled people, but that you intended to do that in a way that would hurt them and benefit you? And, you know, it's so easy to say, who knew? Who could guess? There are lots of answers that could be given, but, you know, it's true that economic life is not fully predictable, and that people don't go into these, iffy transactions without some understanding of what are the selling points and so on. And there is a lot of de facto fraud that just doesn't, you just can't prove the intent as well. And, you know, a lot of it is really a matter of your own conscience. You know, how far are you willing to hurt someone else in order to buy another car or have a nicer house? This is where, you know, again, bull bleep comes in, that people tell themselves a story about what they're doing, which, you know, is closer to being virtuous anyway than a more straightforward description of the fact.
Well, now, in the current system as you describe it, is there any incentive for bank executives not to essentially gamble with depositor dollars? Don't the good banks, the responsible bankers, lose out to the bad?
Yeah, I mean, that's, the last sentence is true. But we need to understand that people should have an interest in honor and character. It's really our whole culture that has soured, the government has given more and more guarantees to bankers. You know, bankers, if we went back to the 19th century, bankers had to convince their fellow citizens that they were people of high character. And if they did things like mega bankers have done in recent years, they would be tarred and feathered and their houses burned down. I mean, those were the controls on bad behavior in a simpler society.
But, you know, both Toledo Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur and Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown have introduced legislation to break up the big banks. They determine them to be a systemic risk to the entire financial system. Is that a good idea? Are they on something there?
They're on something. It isn't, of course, size per se, but that the size perfects the implicit guarantee of being saved in difficult circumstances. So if you can't attack the size directly, which is actually what my proposals try to do, but then this is not a bad second approach. I really admire Sherrod Brown. I think he's one of the few senators who understands what the issues are and is willing to take on the mega bank community on our behalf.
What would your proposals do to limit the size?
Well, it wouldn't be so much to limit the size, but to limit the guarantee. That first, I would change the fraud law. That, you know, I would make the fraud laws more like our traffic laws. That we don't have to prove that a person driving recklessly intended to drive recklessly, and we don't have to prove that he knew that it was reckless to be, say, going 100 miles an hour on a snowy road. We just presume that that knowledge goes with his or her having the right to drive, having experience driving. So people that get promoted to the top of the biggest banks in the world have to understand the deals they make. And we should have to prove that they understand the deals that they make. That the consequences are there, and they have, under prudent man rules, they have a responsibility to acquire the knowledge if they don't have it before they go into the deal. So, you know, it's just like they want to be, it's like teenagers, they want to be treated as children sometimes when they get in trouble. Oh, we're just kids, we're just, you know, having fun. And then when they want to get a car or do other things, they want to be treated as adults. So it's this sort of thing of you made a big deal because of what you know, but oh, you didn't know what you needed to know when things go bad.
Your book indicates that there are numerous zombie banks in the international system with problems so vast their own governments do not have the means to bail them out. And I think I understand you to speculate that the U.S. government or average folks out here in Ohio are going to be dragged into that by our leadership to bail out the world. How likely do you consider that to be, and how would that affect average citizens like the people listening to us right now?
Well, the first point I make is it's so much like the SNL mess, but it's scary, that the SNL mess really didn't have to be cleaned up in 1989. It could have run and run and run for a lot longer. And this was a bunch of zombie SNL. The SNLs that could not, if you liquidated their portfolio, come anywhere near paying off their depositors. And were being subsidized by these implicit guarantees from the government that they would never let them all fail at once. So it's the same way with these big banks. One of the ones that I watch closely is Deutsche Bank. And, you know, its stock price has been going down, and now it's sort of stabilized for a while, but it's not going up like the U.S. banks. And this is because it has a lot of embedded losses that the managers don't want to acknowledge, because they would force themselves into bankruptcy. But as long as nobody challenges that, they can keep putting out reports that show that they have the capital requirements that are set in the international community. You know, all of this is horse bleep, and horse bleep for the financial community and bull bleep for us. That is to say, they don't need to believe it in the financial community. It's just talk.
They don't need to believe it because they believe the government would bail them out in the event of a disaster.
So it's all a cover story to them. I guess that's what I'm saying, that horse bleep is in the nature of a cover story.
Right.
And that bull bleep is a salesman's effort to keep other people from
right. And the horse bleepers don't need to believe it because they believe that the government backstops it, and then not only the German government in Deutsche Bank's case, but the U.S. government because of the interconnectedness of the global financial system.
Yeah, and because I think this is, you went to my prediction of all this, that I believe this is really a very clever strategy by the U.S. mega banks to buy up bank assets in the rest of the world eventually. It's a very long game. They're not playing this for a payout tomorrow or the next week or the next year. But, you know, this, just like the U.S. banking mega banks destroyed the S&L system, you know, it's nothing like what it used to be. And most of those assets were taken over into the banking industry. So it's just another layer of that same game.
So it's financial colonialism.
Right. You could think of that as reverse colonialism in the sense that we were a colony.
Yeah.
That we're going back after the mother countries.
Now, you've just come from the International Monetary Fund meeting in Washington, where the global body released a report detailing major threats to global financial stability. One of the risks identified that we've talked about extensively on this broadcast is the huge capital invested by public pensions in alternative investments that are hard to liquidate and hard to value. States like Ohio, with sovereign immunity, have no one to answer to on these risks, and the dollars involved are actually much higher than any of the assets held by banks in Ohio. How big a risk do you think that is?
Well, you know, that's another one of these, as you obviously understand, it's very parallel in that the financial community of the world cannot let all these pension funds go. At the same time, they eventually will have a hard time making the promised payments, so they're going to have to scale them back. But nobody wants it to happen on their watch. And you can always pray that some major economic breakthrough will put us all back above water again. But you know, it's really the short-sightedness of saying we can put this problem off. We don't have to solve it. And the trouble is, the odds are that the problem grows as we put it off rather than shrink. But I'm sure if it would ever get back to a manageable proportion, something would be done about it.
Now, we're coming upon a presidential election in 2020. Interestingly, in 2016, both political party platforms pledged to restore the Glass-Steagall laws against speculative investment with insured deposits. Following the election, of course, that has been forgotten. Number one, would that work, restoration of Glass-Steagall? And two, why would a high-profile issue that both parties agree on be ignored in Washington?
Well, let me start with the last question. Sometimes both parties agree on a line of horseplay. So, you know, and that's what I think happened, that, people use the metaphor of unscrambling an egg. You know, it would be very costly to try to undo all these connections. And the way that they've been able to get around the restrictions is through holding companies and massive number of subsidiaries. And this is what makes firms too big to liquidate in the sense of a government official looking at it and saying, I can't handle this problem. I don't know how we would handle the problem. But so the biggest deposit institution failures we've faced, which are really holding company failure, is a holding company failure in this sense, was in the S&L industry. And the FDIC took some of its top employees and made them employees or managers of this firm. And they did succeed in allocating its losses and bringing it back in the market to where it could be sold for a fair price. And but at the same time, the FDIC strapped itself of people who might have needed to handle other problems. And you know, we have to assume that they knew, that the people at the FDIC knew that this was the best use of their personnel to stop this one very big firm. But that was still only about $400 billion in size, I think, in asset size, which is nothing like the biggest banks in the world. Again, it's a question of, you, if you ever sat at the cockpit, say, of an airplane, you know, you say, what can all these things do? How? And if you were suddenly asked to fly the plane, you say, oh, I can't do it. I don't know how to do it. I would have to be in training. It'd be months before I could do anything. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the way, that's what really is the source of too big to fail. Fear of getting in there and doing something you don't know how to do, and having to have the help of the very people that you were trying to discipline.
If people listening to this say to themselves, I don't want to participate in this banking BS, what can I do as a consumer to stay out of it? How is there anything I can do to protect myself from people who operate this way?
My short answer is no, there's nothing you can do sort of as an individual. You could, as a political force, get behind people that were coming up with reasonable plans, or at least plans that made things a little better. But, you know, I think the answer has to lie in incentives and in redoing the incentives of these bankers, mega bankers, to enjoy this too big to fail guarantee, that they have got to be punished when things go wrong. They have to know they're going to be punished when things go wrong due to excessive risk taking. So and fraud. So we have to redefine fraud, and we have to establish new responsibility. But as I say, if we let drivers on the road with the disciplinary system we have in banking, it would be unsafe to go out your front door.
So it actually would be indicative of a well-functioning society to see some famous bankers go to prison.
Or at least the first point is to bring them to trial. You know, that it is in fact a punishment to go to trial, because you have to make expenses for lawyers, and maybe people, even if you get off on some technicality, people don't think of you the same anymore. You've suffered a reputational hit. Whereas when they say, oh, we're not going to prosecute so-and-so for this and that, then it tells you sort of that maybe this and that wasn't so bad, and maybe so-and-so is a good guy.
Okay, well. Very good, Dr. Kane. I appreciate your time today, and it's been very enlightening, and I can't wait to read the entire book that must not be named on over-the-air radio.
Yeah, that's right. But I wonder, I assume that if I really wanted to get the exact title, I'd have to call the book Banking Unboldly. But you know, I think there's something to be said for calling things by the right name.
I agree. Thank you so much once again.
Okay, well, it's always good to talk to you, John.
Take care. Bye now.